It is Friday, July 20th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, Trump administration officials participate at a security forum in Colorado. The fear of war is running high on the Gaza border, and we get a glimpse of Shanghai's nightlife in the 1930s.
The biggest, best nightclubs in Shanghai were among the biggest and best in the world in the 1930s.
It's all ahead. White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders announced Thursday on social media that talks are underway to arrange another summit between President Donald Trump and Russian President Vladimir Putin. Sanders said on Twitter that Trump had asked National Security Advisor John Bolton to invite Putin to the White House in the fall. Director of National Intelligence Dan Coats was informed of the potential Putin visit at the Aspen Security Forum in Colorado, and he said he was taken surprised by the news. I'm joined by National Security correspondent Jeff Selden, who's been monitoring the Aspen Forum, and he's here with me in the studio. Jeff, it's quite unusual for an official such as Coats, to learn about a possible visit to the White House by the Russian president, at a public forum like this.
Perhaps in past administrations, past White Houses, where the president and his staff had been in place for some time, this would be unusual. But for President Trump in this White House, it's not really that unusual. There's been a lot of talk by officials at various agencies that a lot of times it's really, the way policy is made. It's not a bottom-up process necessarily. It's not always collaboration. It's what President Trump says, what he says on Twitter sometimes, and then the movement to see, okay, how can that be implemented? President Trump is a president who best could be described perhaps as thinking out loud oftentimes on social media, and then it's up to his staff, his administration, his officials, and the agencies to react and implement policy based on that. So in that way, it's not all that unusual in terms of what input the Director of National Intelligence might have going into this. Well, different presidents use their directors of national intelligence, their intelligence officials differently. Coates said on stage when this was brought up, look, it's the president's prerogative to set these types of things up, specifically the summit in Helsinki. And he also said, it's not really his role to set up those summits, but what the intelligence community is supposed to do is come up with the best intelligence, the necessary intelligence that the president should have going into a meeting with Vladimir Putin, and then give it to him, which is something that they will do.
Well, considering how controversial this just recently ended Helsinki summit has become, and there's been much speculation, of course, as to what happened during those one-on-one talks between Trump and Putin, why consider holding such another talk now?
Lots of officials have said, and I believe Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said just earlier today, that it was important to keep talking. Former officials have said, including a former State Department spokeswoman and ambassador, Victoria Nuland, also speaking at the conference in Aspen, Colorado, said it's important to keep talking, to keep the dialogue going. The question becomes for former and current officials, what do you do with that dialogue? One of the striking things that was said by National Intelligence Director Dan Coats was that he had no idea, like so many other officials, what happened in the one-on-one meeting between President Trump and Russian President Putin in Helsinki, which is striking. And a lot of people have been finding out by what the Russians are saying. And even Coates said, well, we've heard some from the Russians. President Trump has talked a little bit more about it. I'm sure we'll learn. But for many veteran national security officials, intelligence officials, diplomatic officials, that stands out because it puts them on the back foot. They now have to constantly react not just to what President Trump is asking them to do, but to the Russians, which perhaps in some areas there is room to work with Russia on various issues. But in many other ways, the intelligence community has been very clear. Russia has been an adversary engaged in what they term as a great power competition. And to have to find everything out from what the Russians say, for many of them, has been disconcerting. And more, many of them are saying this publicly.
Well, and also having it, it was one thing to have a summit in Helsinki, but to have it within the White House itself, that's kind of unusual.
All you can do is look back at what National Intelligence Director Dan Coats said when he was informed of this on stage. He said, "Say that again." And then he said, and he laughed a little bit with the audience. And then he said, "Okay." And quote, "That's going to be special." Extraordinary language for the country's director of national intelligence in terms of commenting on a high-stakes meeting between the president of the United States and the Russian president.
Well, Jeff, a number of high-ranking officials have been appearing at this forum, and you know you have been monitoring it, and a lot of them have been questioned about Russian interference in the 2016 election. And what generally have they said?
For the most part, they've been saying that they agree with the U.S. intelligence community's declassified assessment of what happened in the 2016 election. It was an assessment that was published in January 2017. The Senate Intelligence Committee just a few weeks ago completed their review and said that they stood behind the intelligence community's findings. And Director Coats, when he was asked about it yesterday, said, look, he said, that they stand by what they assessed, reassessed, and he even defended putting out a statement on Monday after President Trump's comments in Helsinki about being clear in standing behind their findings that Russia did try to influence the presidential election, that the Russian community did develop a preference for then candidate and eventually president-elect Donald Trump, and did take measures to help him in the election. The big question that they won't talk about, and Director Coats refused to talk about, is the special investigation right now being led by that's looking into was or wasn't there active collusion between Trump campaign officials and the Russians. That's yet to be determined. But they said, look, the Russians are behind this. They're going to do it again. And even the Homeland Security Secretary, Kirstjen Nielsen, who hedged on whether or not, who said she believed in the intelligence community's findings and had no reason to doubt them, though she said she disagreed that there was any effort by the Russians to specifically help the Trump campaign. And even when pressed on that, even she said the Russians did it once, they're going to do it again, and it would be foolish to think that they're not going to try in the upcoming midterm elections. And in fact, some private security officials with Microsoft even said that during the primaries and earlier this year, three congressional candidates, prominent congressional candidates who are running for election, were this targeted by hackers with phishing attempts to try to infiltrate their campaigns. High-profile people that would be of interest to a nation state like Russia, though they stopped short of saying the Russians did it. Although the methods and the ways that the attacks were being conducted, similar to what the Russians did during the Democratic and Republican conventions in 2016. But it's already started happening. The volume isn't there yet, security officials say, but just about every single national security intelligence official who's testified before Congress or spoken to the public has said the Russians did it, they're going to do it again, and the U.S. has to prepare itself.
All right, thanks very much. That's VOA National Security Correspondent Jeff Selden. Here are some of the top news stories that are trending. A Kazakh Olympic figure skater has been stabbed to death. At least 13 people are dead as a tourist boat capsizes in the Branson, Missouri area. French President Macron will fire a bodyguard filmed hitting a May Day protester. And North Korea's economy declines due to international sanctions. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOANews.com website. This is VOA. This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, we meet the author of a new book about 1930s Shanghai. Nearly 4 months of Palestinian protests on the border of the Hamas-ruled Gaza Strip in Israel are raising concerns of yet another war. Robert Berger reports for VOA from Jerusalem.
Israel has been fighting brush fires on the Gaza border every day for more than 3 months, thanks to a primitive but effective new Palestinian weapon. Militants are sending burning kites across the frontier, torching vast areas of Israeli farmland and forests. Now Israel is running out of patience. That became clear a week ago when Israel launched its heaviest airstrikes on the ruling Islamic militant group Hamas since the Gaza War in 2014. Yisrael Katz, a member of the Security Cabinet, said Israel has drawn a red line. It will not allow terror from Gaza to continue, whether it is attack tunnels, rockets, or kites. An activist in the Hamas kite unit told Israel Television that there is only one way to stop the raging fires. The crippling Israeli blockade imposed on Gaza 11 years ago must be lifted. He said the Palestinians are demanding the free flow of food, medicine, and fuel, which Israel has curtailed in response to the flaming kite attacks. Despite the defiance, the Israeli pressure tactics could be having an effect. Ibrahim al-Madhoun, a Palestinian journalist with close ties to Hamas, says the group is rethinking its strategy. He said stopping the burning kites may be necessary to avert all-out war with Israel. Hamas and Israel have fought 3 wars in the past decade, and the prevention of the fourth might come down to who blinks first. Robert Berger for VOA News, Jerusalem.
Now some health news. For more than 30 years, doctors have worked to save people's arms and legs that once might have been lost. VOA's Carol Pearson reports, saving a limb after an accident or infection can take an entire team of specialists at a limb preservation center.
That was a kick to the ball from an athlete on Nigeria's amputee football team. Everyone on this team is missing a leg or an arm. But these athletes have an eye on winning the World Amputee Football Federation's World Cup in Mexico this fall. With prosthetics, amputees can do things almost as well as, or even better than, whole-bodied people. Of course, most people prefer not to lose a limb. Jeff Bope nearly lost his arm after an accident in a utility vehicle when the driver lost control. The vehicle flipped, Bope's arm snapped, and the muscle and skin were torn away.
The way they described it in the medical reports, it was a near-field amputation.
Bope was flown to the University of Missouri Healthcare's Trauma Center.
Met him in the emergency room. We were concerned we may not be able to save his arm.
Dr. Jay Bridgman, a limb reconstruction specialist at the University of Missouri Healthcare, was called in.
We took a muscle from his back and we used that to lay over the areas that were exposed that had lost tissue. And then that required the skill of the microsurgeon to sew the blood vessels together and the nerves together.
After more than a dozen surgeries, Bridgman says these procedures helped save Bope's hand.
What's key for him that he will have that's better than a prosthesis is a hand that has sensation, so he can feel objects and use the hand.
Saving limbs requires a team of doctors with different specialties. At the Cleveland Clinic, Dr. Lee Kirksey says the majority of patients who get limb-saving surgeries have diabetes.
About one-third of diabetics at some point will develop an ulcer on their feet. And so where I see this area of limb salvage progressing is that we'll become better and more skilled and have more technology in restoring blood flow for these patients.
There will always be patients whose limbs can't be saved, which is why there is a great focus on making better prosthetics.
What we focus on in that case is getting that patient a well-constructed amputation of some sort, getting them into a prosthetic, and then they're wildly surprised about how they're able to achieve a normal activity level in their life.
Carol Pearson, VOA News.
This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's newsmaker interview program. Join us each Saturday and Sunday when we talk with authors, analysts, and policymakers who provide fresh insight on topics ranging from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. That's Press Conference USA, every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.
This is International Edition. A new book explores the legendary nightclubs of 1930s Shanghai as World War II approached. The city's international population at that time included white Russians escaping the Soviet Union and Jewish refugees from Nazi-controlled Europe. The book centers on two men, Jewish nightclub owner Joe Farren, who had fled his birthplace of Vienna, and American outlaw Jack Riley. Much of the action takes place in Shanghai's international settlement, which was controlled by several countries. Author Paul French stopped by VOA this week to talk with me about his book, City of Devils.
But if you're looking for rogues, chancers, and adventurers, Shanghai gives you a massive cast. But I had to only find two. And they really interested me because they were reported on a lot. Joe was reported on a lot. He was from Vienna. He was an exhibition dancer who came to Shanghai, danced with his wife, Nellie, like a sort of, you know, Fred and Ginger Rogers type dance act, and went on to run the chorus lines and the shows at most of the biggest, best nightclubs in Shanghai. And the biggest, best nightclubs in Shanghai were among the biggest and best in the world in the 1930s. But he always wanted to run his own casino, the biggest casino in Asia. Jack Riley, who he came to know, was from America, and he was an ex-Navy guy who in the 1920s had been involved in a kidnapping and sent to the Oklahoma State Penitentiary for 34 years. Tough sentence. But he escaped from prison, burnt his fingerprints off, and went to Shanghai, which was the only city in the world where you didn't need a passport, didn't need a visa. You could just walk off the boat and give them any name you wanted. So it attracted these kind of people. And he also introduced slot machines to Shanghai and made a fortune. So both of them were doing quite well, and they wanted to open this, the biggest nightclub and casino that had ever been opened.
It was also interesting reading in the book about some jazz musicians from Harlem who came over and played at some of these clubs.
Shanghai was the most modern city in Asia by a long way. Neon lights, jazz, the first city in Asia with elevators, central heating, telephones in hotel rooms, all of that. It loved modern things. And it took very quickly to jazz. Joe Farren, who was running nightclubs, realized that that jazz was the thing. And they were using musicians often from the Philippines and elsewhere. But what Joe Farren did, and then several others afterwards, was come to America, where there were many African-American jazz bands that weren't doing so well because of the Depression in the 1930s. So he booked American jazz bands to come over and play in Shanghai. And the biggest one he booked, and the most successful in China by a long way, was Buck Clayton and his Harlem Gentlemen. And they came over. Buck Clayton was an academic of jazz, really. He also worked with Chinese musicians to try and combine Chinese musical notation with African-American jazz rhythms and so on to create what they called yellow jazz at the time. But Buck claimed with his band and his wife, Darby, who was a great jazz singer as well in the sort of style of Lena Horne or someone like that. And they came, and they came suited up straight from Los Angeles, and they blew Shanghai apart. Shanghai had never seen anything like this. Of course, all the African-American jazz bands that came to Shanghai loved Shanghai because of being an international city, there was no segregation. So they didn't have to go in the back doors of anywhere. They didn't have to eat in certain restaurants and things like that. It was a completely open town for them. They could go where they wanted, spend their money how they wanted, sleep with who they wanted. They could do exactly what they wanted. So like the jazz musicians that went to Paris after the First World War from America, they loved going to Shanghai as well.
Well, now as time goes on, the Japanese get closer and closer, but I believe they stayed on the outside of this particular area.
Well, so the international settlement is surrounded by Chinese Shanghai and then, of course, the rest of China. When the Japanese attacked in August of 1937, which is really the start of the Second World War, effectively, they did not invade the international settlement and the French concession, because to do so would have meant going to war in the summer of 1937 with Britain, with America, and with France. And Japan did not want to do it at that time. So it became what the Chinese called the Gudao, or the solitary or lonely island. But the party went on. You would have thought everybody would evacuate. And indeed, there were evacuation ships. But, of course, most of these people, including my cast of characters, had no passports. They were stateless people. Well, Jack Riley still owed the American taxpayer 32 years in Oklahoma State Penitentiary. But, you know, by this time, the Jews that are arriving from Europe have no passports, and all of the Russians have no passports, and, of course, all of the criminals can't go anywhere because they'll be arrested. So Shanghai kept on swinging, even though war raged all around it.
It must have been interesting and maybe challenging doing research on this book, because a lot of these characters are sort of people, I guess you could say, at the margins of society. They're not the government people that were the well-known particularly.
And of course, they all lie. You know, they deny anything. It's like, you know, prisons are full of innocent people. No one in prison's guilty, right? No one's ever guilty of anything. Everyone lies about their name. All the women lie about their age. They give different names when they get on boats. You know, so tracking them down and finding things. They lie in court. Of course, you know, none of that means anything to them. So you never know quite what they're saying. You've got to find different pieces of information, often of which are sort of, you know, anecdotes, apocryphal, gossip, and try and match it all up to get something of the best image of these people that you can. But there is a little bit of guesstimate involved in it. But I think we get as close as we possibly can. But of course, if they were alive today, they'd all deny everything.
So I smile and say, when a lovely flame dies, smoke gets in your eyes.
I was talking to Paul French. He's the author of City of Devils. That's our show. I'm Sarah Williams. Have a great weekend.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Fostering economic development in sub-Saharan Africa is a top priority of the United States, and the African Growth and Opportunity Act, or AGOA, is the centerpiece of U.S. trade policy on the continent. The Trump administration places great importance on our relationship with Africa and sees genuine promise in the prospects for enhanced trade relationships with our partners, said Deputy Secretary of State John Sullivan. Speaking at the 17th annual AGOA Forum in Washington, D.C. in mid-July, Deputy Secretary Sullivan noted that the U.S. partnership with African countries is based on a number of strategic priorities. We work together to strengthen regional security, reinforce democratic governance, and increase trade and investment, he said.
We do all of these things because we understand that security and democratic institutions provide a stable foundation for economic growth and prosperity. At the same time, increased trade and investment are key to creating jobs and generating resources that strengthen security and democracy. When partners increase their capacity to confront real security challenges that we all face, we demonstrate how alliance building through economic cooperation promotes security.
Africa is the major market of the future, said Deputy Secretary Sullivan. Some of the world's fastest-growing economies call Africa home. We expect that over the next three decades, half of the world's population growth will occur in Africa. And that means a projected 1.2 billion new consumers will enter the African market, said Mr. Sullivan.
These trends, combined with Africa's growing youth population, will allow African countries to capitalize on a growing labor force. This great opportunity will come with challenges, however, including the need to provide jobs for this growing population. Expansion of trade and investment will be critical to meeting this challenge.
The United States applauds efforts such as the signing last March of the African Continental Free Trade Agreement framework because it advances another key component, regional integration. The United States stands ready to partner with African countries that are committed to reducing barriers to trade and investment, said Deputy Secretary Sullivan. In doing so, we hope to encourage policy reforms that increase openness and competitiveness within Africa and promote greater prosperity and higher living standards across the continent.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States.